Hello?
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Family Matters. Welcome. I'm here with my host. This is Julie Jeezy, and I'm here with my host, Judge Michelle Laurence. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Jill, and hi, everybody who's listening.
How are you today?
Gorgeous.
Tell
it's
us,
fantastic in Chicago. Fantastic.
Oh, weather in Springfield, Illinois was absolutely beautiful. This is the perfect place to be today. And I don't think you, after we had the notoriety of being the third most violent place in the country today on Fox and CNN News. Yes, isn't that amazing? Springfield, Illinois, the third most violent place in the country.
And is that statistic even true, even when you're out of town?
I can't believe it. Even when I'm out of town, it's true. You know, it's crazy to me, but I suppose they have some sort of formula that puts that together. This was for 2010. And, you know, there are a lot of violent crimes going on in Springfield, Illinois, but I just can't imagine it would be more than Detroit or more than, you know, and I don't know if they're how they're gauging all of this. But I feel safe right here tonight with my Bernese Mountain Dogs. I'm looking at them laying on the porch, so I'm good. How's little Nietzsche tonight? The little teacup Pomeranian.
We'll see as the show progresses.
We will. You know, we are supposed to have the lovely Karen Conti tonight, and she has not called in yet, and I'm not quite sure why. So we will chat it up a moment until we think maybe she is not getting
here. Well, let's talk about what we're going to talk about, because if people are thinking of that this might be the night that they're going to call into the show.
Yeah.
Let's tell them what it's about, because to me, what we're going to talk about is very future-oriented thinking. Maybe one of the first... Is she there?
No. Keep going. I'll tell
and
you.
And one of the first real trajectories towards a new paradigm shift in how people break up families and divorce, which is now includes civil unions. And we're talking about, among other things tonight, collaborative law. And we've all heard rumors about what's collaborative law, but we are going to really go in depth with it, see how that faces off or impacts parental alienation, visitation interference, and how it does or doesn't help families.
Well, tell me, you know, because when I started this process back in 1996, I don't even know, did they even have collaborative law then?
No, I don't think they did.
No, probably not. So when did this all begin, Michelle? When did you start seeing it?
I'm going to say 10 years ago, but we're seeing more of it now. Let me talk about what it is for the people who like it. What is that? It is the opposite of the traditional adversarial model. That's the first thing I want to say about it. The second thing is you each hire your own attorney, but you enter into a written contract that says if the collaborative process doesn't work, we cannot go to court against each other, that the parties have to hire new attorneys. Now, the first thing you think of when you hear that is, that's the last thing I want to do, is hire a new attorney. It's enough I had to hire one, let alone, but it's an agreement to agree. And the agreement to agree puts the children on a pedestal. We agree to become allies to save our children.
Right.
We will, if we're doing it wrong, we have social workers, we have psychologists, we let the school psychologists know. We do everything to create an alliance. And then there's financial experts. And the financial experts weigh in on the money. So it's a collaborative, that's where the word comes from. You have
right.
a team of people to dismantle your family.
Well, I just picked Karen up, so she's here. Hi, Karen. Maybe not.
This is Nicole.
Oh, hi, Nicole. Okay, hang on just a second, okay? Hold on.
Sure.
Just 1 second.
Sure.
Okay. Well, Michelle, she's not here yet. I've just sent an email to Karen, and I know she was in court this afternoon, so we will be hoping that she is out and ready to go. And she is a collaborative law advocate, and she is licensed in collaborative law. So that's why we picked this topic for tonight. Now, Hang on. I got her right here. Here she is.
I am here. I am
Hi
so
there.
Sorry. I got caught up in court, of all things.
I just said that. I knew you had a good reason for being late because you had to go to court. How are you, Karen Conte?
Good. I am fine. Jill, how are you?
Great. And Michelle is here.
Hi, Karen.
Hi, Michelle.
You could not have had a great day.
I did not have a great day, but I'm going to have a great talk with you, too.
No, I
well,
know,
I'm
because
glad.
You're that kind of woman.
She
knows how to do that.
Well, and we right. should tell our listeners, not our viewers, because they can't see us, our listeners a little bit about you, Karen. You are the managing partner at Adamski & Conte, and I think we need to make special mention, without getting too sad, about Greg Adamski, your husband, who passed away this year, and we all knew him and thought so much of him, and you are now holding the reins of the firm and keeping it all together, and you do so many great things. Your practice spans everything from representing John Wayne Gacy to you just do a little bit of everything. Divorce, you're doing the collaborative thing now. You have your own radio show, Legally Speaking, on WGN. You're a commentator on Fox. What don't you do?
I don't have a lot of time to watch TV, which is a good thing because I don't like television anymore. But you know what? Yes, and thank you for the kind words about Greg. I practiced with him for 21 years. He was my my partner and my husband, and as your listeners might know from anyone who's ever had a tragedy, it's awful. And so what you do is you try to, reinvent yourself. You try to change things up. You try to move ahead. You try to keep yourself busy. And kind of just move forward and with the idea that you're always going to keep that person in your heart, but that you got your whole life ahead of you.
Well, on that note, we have three callers waiting right now, and I don't ever like to leave people on hold. So if you don't, both of you don't mind, I'm going to grab these calls.
Yeah, grab the call, and
Let's
I just want to tell Karen that I took a stab at just defining what collaborative law was.
Okay.
But it will become much clearer as you talk about it. So maybe they're calling in about that.
Right. Not easy
okay.
to define. Yes.
So I'm going to grab a call. Okay. 312-546. How are you? And do you have a question for Michelle or Karen?
312-546. How are you? And do you have a question?
They're not listening to me. I can hear the feedback in the background. Okay. I'm going to put that guy on hold.
Discussion somewhere
and
there.
I'm going to go to the 319 area code. How are you tonight? No one wants to talk to us. They're all here, but they're too shy.
We're getting
okay,
the silent treatment.
Let's go to Nicole. Nicole, are you there?
Hi. Yes, I am. How are you doing tonight?
Do you have a question for Karen?
Yes, I do. I have a situation where I am divorced, and I have gone through the mediation process 2 times now. What do you do? Well, my situation is I was married to a man that was not a United States citizen. He had stated that he was going to become one. His whole family are citizens, but he is not. And he has threatened to remove my child from the States if he doesn't get what he wants, whenever he wants, and how he wants it, and is now putting me through court. I have court on the 17th of this month. And he is taking me to court because I have just recently become low vision, and he's stating that because of my low vision, I'm not capable of taking care of my 6-year-old son anymore. My 6-year-old son is the first of the first of the first of the first. They are Asian Indian, and I am Caucasian, American born. My son is American born. And I'm worried that there's going to be a fleet. I'm worried that he's going to get up and run someday when he realizes. He's taking me to court right now to take sole custody.
Well, it's Nicole, right?
Yes.
Nicole, the first thing that I would do, and I'd like everyone to pipe in, but, I mean, you can ask the judge to, does the child have a passport? I would, if that's the case.
No,
the child,
there is no passport. I've never allowed a passport. You have to have 2 parents to have a passport.
Right.
My understanding. I've never allowed it yet.
Okay.
I don't know if he can do it without me.
Okay, I mean, if there's a will, there's a way, I suppose, but I don't know how he's going to get out of the country with a child without a passport. And if you don't sign one, if you don't have one, I don't know. I mean, I understand.
Okay.
I understand that your concern is, and it is a very difficult thing once a child
you know
is
it's
removed.
You know it's out there, and you know it's happening. So that's not really my main concern, I guess. My concern is, what do you do when the mediation doesn't work because one parent refuses it. He walks in, lies to the mediator, blatantly lies to the mediator.
If mediation
the children
is only,
are in the room...
Yeah, mediation is only good when the two parties can talk and reach across
okay.
the table and agree to settle. If someone doesn't want to
okay.
settle, or if someone's so angry, or someone has mental illness, you know, that's, mediation doesn't work. I mean, I think Michelle
what
probably
is that
could
next
weigh in.
Step? So what is that next step that I would do? That's where I'm lost.
Well, at that point, you're going to have to defend the case.
Okay.
At this point, you're going to have to get, you know, your finances together. You're going to have to get your resources together, get yourself
yeah.
a good attorney. And, you know, if you were the primary caretaker, were you the primary caretaker of the child?
Oh, since the day that beautiful baby was
okay.
born.
So you're just going to have to keep good records of what he says and what your child does and how much time you spend with the child, and you're going to have to convince the court that the status quo is what should be honored. You have been the primary caretaker until he decided to get divorced, and then at this point he now wants to be daddy. So, you know,
yeah.
you're going to have
well,
to
maybe
fight,
he doesn't,
Nicole.
Maybe he doesn't. One, and
no,
Karen
he doesn't.
And Gail,
actually,
you
this
both
is what
know
he
one
wants.
Of the great weapons.
Let me, what he wants is for my son to live with his parents in their home and be raised in their Malayalam, it's Malayalam Indian Catholic school. So he would learn Malayalam, which is good. I am all for him knowing his culture. I want him to know all of both worlds. I want him to have it all. But I don't, they want to take him from me and put him living with his grandparents, not his dad. His dad doesn't want him. His dad won't. His dad works. He's too busy working, making the money. That's his job. He works. He makes the money. And everybody else is there to take care of the kids.
Well,
okay,
so
Nicole. I'm gonna let Michelle weigh in, and Karen will finish up. I'm gonna let them answer your question, and then Karen
okay.
will give her information at the end of the
okay.
show. Possibly you
sure.
can contact her. Okay.
Okay. Thank you
okay,
so much.
Okay. Listen in. Thanks for calling, Nicole. Go ahead, Michelle.
One of the things to always remember is. In so many cases, there's a threat of a custody fight by one party or the other without the means or the finances to see it through. One of the great ways to bully a wife in this particular case is to say, I'm going to take your child. You don't know what all the reasons are and all the hostility is all about, but it could be far away from him actually doing that. And if it's true that he's not going to be parenting, and it's the grandparents that are parenting, that would only work in your favor. So there's a lot of variables. But any way you cut it, because of these kind of threats, and because you do have to ready yourself and steel yourself for the possibility that they are real, mostly, Karen will tell you, mostly they're not. But you really need a good lawyer to help you get centered.
That's true, and you just one more thing to add is, you know, the thing that hurts a woman the most, you know, is the threat of taking the child away, and he knows that. He knows that's the way to get to her and to harm her and to threaten her in the way that he feels harmed and threatened. So, you know, you're right, Michelle, but that doesn't mean you just lay down the sword and wait to be stabbed.
You can't. But and the other thing is, a lot of mediation doesn't work the first time or the second time, and that doesn't even kind of mean the case doesn't eventually settle. 90% of the cases do settle. Most people can't afford litigation.
And
mediation
is really
expensive.
Mediation, don't you agree, Michelle, allows parties to vent? So maybe this angry husband or ex-husband-to-be is going to get something out of mediation by just yelling and screaming at her for a while, even though
right.
that's abusive and that's not a good thing.
I don't
yeah.
know, because I think the cultural aspect of this particular case puts a whole different level of you have to be on guard with this. And,
you're
and I
right,
think,
Jill.
I think the cultural part of it is different. And if you watch the movie Not Without My Daughter with Sally Field, when the daughter was taken to Iran or Iraq, I don't remember which now, but this is a whole different culture that they're dealing with. And these people have a different mindset than an American mindset. So I think this is a whole different ball game than what we normally deal with in someone who wants to take custody away from a mom or to, you know, alienate a child. So I think this is a different deal.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. You could be right about that.
Okay, I got a couple more calls here, guys. Let's try area code 319. Are you there?
I'm here.
What's your question?
I'm looking for a little advice or what direction I need to go.
Okay, question?
I'm sorry?
Your question.
My question. I have been in a custody situation where we're trying to determine. 4 years ago, my son was born. She was granted sole custody. I was given a visitation, liberal visitation, but they did sever my custodial rights. The reasoning behind the severance of my custodial rights were I had gone through some very rough emotional times, and I had gotten two OWIs, which is driving while intoxicated, within two-month period. None of them were relative to having the child. In fact, the child had not been in my care at any time prior to those. They had actually obtained a no-contact order against me prior to me even relocating to this state. As a strategical move in order to prevent me from being in any sort of physical care of the child. I have since established over the last 4 years a very wonderful relationship with my child. I have gone through what is basically been what I feel is a complete lie that the court has basically substantiated the claims of the parties that were involved on the mother's side. There was false testimony that was made, and this was all put into an order. And unfortunately, at the time, I didn't have the money to follow through with an appeal or do an appeal. I've since enrolled myself into school again, and I've become very educated in the legal aspect of the field. And I do facilitation of meetings in Iowa here for other parents that are having problems as well, and drafting legal paperwork for them. My question is, I guess, I'm coming up to a point where we have gone through our second mediation process. The mother cannot make decisions on her own. She never has been able to. She has brought her attorney to mediation, and her attorney has said everything for her.
Can you give us a question, and then we'll tell you how much background we need? Start with the question, and then we'll fill in how much we need to know.
I have an opportunity to litigate this, and I have an opportunity to mediate it. They are willing to give me something more, but we exercise 50-50 joint physical care for the entire 2010 year. When I wanted to get it in writing, they then reneged, or she reneged, she lawyered up and said, "You're going back to the minimal visitation." I don't know whether I should mediate this, because I think that they know that I have a case now.
So your question is mediate or litigate, right?
Correct.
Karen?
I mean, without knowing all of the details and all, because it sounds like there's a lot of moving parts here, I always say to people it's better to agree to something that is not quite what you want than to let a government official in a robe who doesn't know you or your children making that decision based upon what little few facts that person knows. Always better to compromise. Always better to have both parties invested in the answer to the question rather than to be forced into it. And whether you like your ex-spouse or not, sounds like it probably is not a good relationship, you still have to co-parent with her on some level. You're going to be sitting next to her at your child's wedding. You're going to be, you know, sitting there at christenings or whatever the issue is. So you have a long history, and to me, without, again, knowing what's being offered and what you could get in court, going to court is probably the worst option.
And what a brilliant answer I think that is, Karen, because Michelle will take no offense at that answer, I know, because she and I will always say showing up in court and thinking that common sense is going to prevail, and that somebody, a judge, is looking at a five-minute snapshot of your life, and you're thinking that the right decisions are going to be made from this very small amount of time is just wrong. So if you can do anything to mediate and make a decision with your ex-spouse, I think that is so incredibly important. Michelle?
Plus, I would add on to that you have no downside. that the best or the worst that can happen is that you learn a little bit about each other. Even if you don't come to an agreement, maybe you'll pick up a communication skill. Maybe you'll understand a little bit more about her. If you don't reach an agreement, you're only a couple of months behind where you started anyway. Anything that can facilitate rapport isn't judged strictly on whether or not you come out with an agreement. There's different levels of success.
Thanks for calling. Great. We appreciate it. I'm going to go to caller in the 111 area code. Think that's a Skype call. Are you there? Caller, are you there? Nope. Okay, one more call. We're going to go to the 312-546 area code. Are you there?
Yes.
Do you have a question?
Yes, my question is, what are we doing to get past the mindset for collaborative divorce? Because right now, attorneys are trained as, you know, in an adversarial role. And usually, lots of, you know, if I have a client, they want to sit there and potentially mediate. However, lawyers do not think that way, and if I ask the other side to mediate, usually I'm getting no way in hell. So the thing is, how do we get past that mindset? And the mindset goes pretty far up. I've had former ISBA presidents specifically tell me that collaborative divorce is malpractice, is legal malpractice, in his opinion.
Ah, interesting. Well, that's a big open-ended question, and there's a lot to talk about there. I think that you're right that people are not ready to do collaborative law. People, it's what people's expectations are. And listen, if you have something serious happen to you, like a divorce, where everything up in the air, everything that's worth anything to you is up in the air, you think that, what is the best thing I can do? And people say, well, get your lawyer and you fight. That's what your expectation is. That's the what you think you're entitled to. That's what you think the method is, unless someone tells you otherwise. So, yes, I think we all need to be reeducated into the idea that collaborative law, mediation, all of those things that are more conducive to coming up with good solutions for family issues, that should be our expectation. That should be our goal, rather than fighting it out in court and having the government official make the decision. You know, again, you're right. There are some lawyers who poo-poo mediation and collaborative law, and they think maybe they can make more money doing it. But you can, you know, lawyers can still have a great profession doing collaborative and mediation, because people will always need attorneys to advise them maybe what their rights are. And so when they go into it, they know what their rights are, and they can make options and take options and make choices.
I'd like to add on to that, if I could. Remember how long... You're an attorney, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Remember how long it took to get no fault. Remember how long it took to get joint parenting. Remember how right now the presumption is still alternating weekends and Wednesday for dinner. You've got to set your trajectory somewhere else. The collaborative model is not perfect. It's far from it, but at least it's the first time we're acknowledging how excruciatingly difficult and nuanced and psychological what it takes to break up a family. The collaborative model is the first one that is embracing how difficult this process really is. So that's where we need to set our sights. This is the wave of the future. People are demanding doing divorcing a different way than how they've been doing it for 40 years. We look around us and we see the wreckage everywhere from the traditional adversarial model. At least people like Karen and others, really insightful wisdom seekers, are looking to do it a different way. We will work out the kinks.
I'm finding the harder sell is not for the parties. The harder sell is to the other attorney.
Well, we're trained to be adversarial. When you're a litigator, you are trained to file motions, and you're trained to go to court, and you're trained to be an adversary for the position, whatever that is. And so I understand why it's harder for lawyers to let go of that. You know, and maybe we need to start in the law schools, and maybe we need to have mandatory training for people who are practicing this area. I just don't know. I also think that mediation and those kinds of things should be done in a mandatory way right up front. I think it's Colorado. I was talking to Jill about this earlier, that in Colorado, I believe in certain jurisdictions, there's a mandatory mediation that happens before before you even get to file a divorce. So before there's an indoctrination into the whole system of adversary pleadings versus, you know, Roe versus Roe, you have to go handhold a little bit. And, you know, maybe that's the solution, because before the adversary process kicks in, we now are talking settlement right from the get-go, as opposed to vice versa.
Well, one thing I see is there's always going to be a problem with those people, and you mentioned it earlier, Karen, you know, the psychological mental issue people
sure.
who are just going to fight no matter what, so I'm
right.
not sure how to get beyond that. Now, one other issue I wanted to hit on, because I got a call about this a year ago. Somebody asked me if I wanted to buy a franchise into one of these collaborative divorce things. I guess they're becoming popular in Canada, I was told. And I don't know if you know anything about that. Not that I'm looking to buy a franchise.
I never heard that. McDonald's, yes. Collaborative drive-thru, I don't think so.
Well, no, it's not drive-thru, but you basically submit to these people, and they have hired on their staff psychiatrists, you know, basically all the things you have in collaborative divorce, psychiatrists, CPAs and stuff, attorneys, and they put together the package, and you mediate. They put together a package and submit it to the court. But they're finding, I'm told, in Canada, a market for that where people
and,
are
and it is
do
doing quite well, day. Isn't it, Mick? I think, and it's got a really catchy name, and I can't remember.
I remember it's golf related to one.
Fairway.
It's Fairway Divorce.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, thanks for calling, Mick. We appreciate it. And
thanks,
keep listening. I'm going to pick up another call from the 508 area code. Hi, 508. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good. Do you have a question?
Actually, I do. What if you get to the point where you're past doing anything collaborative or in mediation, where you have an ex-spouse that is threatening and violent, like in a case where your spouse is an ex-state trooper and knows people in the system, and you know, you feel like you can't fight it.
So your question is, you said your past mediation,
there
your past collaborative,
no...
so therefore, by definition, you're in the adversarial, the traditional model, correct? The two-lawyer combative argument, winner-takes-all paradigm, right?
Can't even get a lawyer. No lawyer will touch the case in Massachusetts because everybody says, well, this person's a Massachusetts
okay, so
state
let's stop
trooper.
Right here. You can't say, so you are not fighting with him. You can't get a lawyer. He has a lawyer?
Yeah.
Okay, so your problem is you have no lawyer.
Right.
Is that what your question is? What do you do if you have
correct.
No lawyer?
Correct. Well, I'm calling on behalf of a friend. I've already gone through mediation in my own case, and this person had to sign custody of her children over at gunpoint, and, you know, she doesn't... have a
okay,
clue
but we need
on
a,
what
we
to
need
do.
A question because we want to
well,
educate
I
everybody.
Well, I want to know, you know, what do you do when you try to go to court, you try to fight on your own, but you can't get a lawyer because as soon as you talk to any lawyer, they hear, oh, well, this person's a state trooper and they know everybody, so there's nothing we can do.
So what do you do? So, Karen, what do you do if nobody will take your case, which seems kind of unlikely, but let's just say.
I mean, there's always somebody to take the case. I mean, I know I'm not going to.
This would be a job for Greg Adamski.
He had more testosterone than all of the NFL put together with steroids. I think, you know, first of all, and I'm really not downplaying what you're saying, but you cannot give people more power than they have. And I think that's a real common element in divorce where I see this especially with women, but I see it with men too, where they think that their spouse has all the power and authority and they can do anything and the whole system is going to work in their favor. And you know what? Don't give them that power, even if he is a state trooper. I mean, in this day and age, do state troopers get to, you know, go and beat people up? They really don't. And they have more to lose than anybody when they do that kind of thing. So unless I hear some specifics about how this person has infiltrated the system and taken advantage of it, I'm not sure that this is, you know, all real. And I'm not downplaying. If someone's violent, you got to be careful. You got to get your protective orders and you got to do all those things. But let's look at the reality of this. I don't know what else to say about that.
Yeah, well, I think you said it.
I don't know. I mean, I know in my case, I had to deal with a very large and overwhelmed probate family court, and I never went to mediation. Everything always went before a judge because there was a guardian ad litem involved, and everything that the guardian ad litem said was taken at, you know, for gospel. I was willing to go for mediation, and the other party wasn't.
Well,
okay,
we'll
so do you have a question relating to your own set of circumstances?
Well, yeah, in my own case, you know, I mean, what do you do in that case when you want to do mediation and the other party doesn't?
Two to tango.
Monica, I'm going to let that, we're going to answer that question, and I'm going to hang up, okay?
Okay.
All right. Go ahead, ladies.
You can't do
it.
You know, there's court in Cook County and in most jurisdictions, there's court-ordered mediation. So you can get somebody to show up at mediation. That doesn't mean they have to participate in it. But even if they say no and they have to show up, something could be gained. But really, if somebody wants to fight, even if it's temporarily, even if it's when the case is fresh and people are at their highest and most exuberant anger, they are going to fight. Eventually, they might use what they learned, file it in the back Rolodex, and use it later. Most people can't afford the fight, ultimately.
Agreed.
Well, let's go back to the beginning of the show when Karen was still in court and Michelle was giving us a definition of collaborative law, which was very good. But, Karen, I want to hear your definition of collaborative law and how you make it work in your practice and how successful it's been. I mean, so there's about 80 million questions here. And what maybe even walk us through a case, because I know that when I started in 1996, I didn't know there was anything like this. And I asked Michelle earlier, did this even exist in 1996? Were people using the collaborative law model then?
I don't think so. I think California probably was the first. Michelle probably knows the history of it better. But, you know, essentially, I think there's different ways, different models of the collaborative law process. And I think you can use bits and pieces of it. And not all of it has to be done exactly the same way. But the general definition is that you come into the process without an adversary system, and that everything you do is by collaboration with the assistance of people who are specialized and concentrated on your particular issues. So let's say the two parties come in, there's a person who facilitates the conversation, the issues are identified, and let's just say there's financial issues. There's one person who is a financial neutral, we'll call him, and he comes in and he says, I want to see everybody's tax returns, and I want to see what the wife needs, I want to see what the husband needs, and I want to see where you're going to live and what your rent is, and all these things, and he kind of processes them and helps the parties reach a resolution of, say, those financial issues. If you have children's issues, visitation, who's going to make decisions, where are people going to live, there is a child representative or child, you know, neutral who comes in and tries to facilitate those types of things, and that person could be a social worker or a person who's kind of, you know, got some insight into children's issues. So the people that are assisting have some financial and some psychological background, which enables them to really assist in facilitating agreements. But that's the bottom line, the facilitating of agreements on all of these issues. And so there are a series of meetings where the parties get together with these financial neutrals, with attorneys who help them through the process. And it's probably a big group of people, considering, you know, how most settlement conferences go. You might have 6 or 7, 8 people in one room trying to bring the two parties together to reach an agreement. And that agreement may or may not have anything to do with what the parties are entitled to. So, you know, maybe I'm entitled to half the income, and maybe I'm entitled to visitation every other weekend, but maybe I agree to something more or less in both those realms because that is what is best for this family. So it's a very tailored kind of goal, you know, tailored to what you want, not what the court says. And
but I want to take you – I want to take you out of Cook County for a second. And if we say we're going to come down here to Menard County in Petersburg, a place you love, Abraham Lincoln's, you know, for all intents and purposes, hometown, because he really was from Kentucky, even though we say he was from here.
Kentucky who?
How does somebody in Petersburg, Illinois, Menard County, Illinois, find out about collaborative law? Because I can tell you in Sangamon County, Illinois, the capital of Springfield, or the capital, which is Springfield, Illinois, that collaborative law isn't something that happens. I mean, we have a cottage industry here that's fed by lawyers and judges and court-appointed advocates and GALs, and collaborative law comes up very, very rarely. So
well,
how
think,
does somebody
think, impede- think why? You know what? Here's an answer with an answer, a question with an answer. I don't know, an answer with a question. I was thinking of putting this stuff on my website, which I actually did, and I'm thinking, should I put it on my website? Because when people are looking for a family law lawyer, I have collaborative and mediation. They may say, oh my God, I want a bulldog. I want someone who's going to handhold and play, you know, kumbaya.
Mm-hmm.
I actually thought that because I understand that people, when they expect to get divorced, they expect to have somebody who's going to fight. They don't have the expectation. So how do you advertise it without having a lengthy explanation in the ad, right? You know,
right.
Try collaborative law. Here's what it is. And even then, how do you explain that in a way that you can see that it works?
Well, don't you think it's geared to a particular demographic? I mean, it's not for someone like me in the divorce that I was in. It's not for someone who isn't speaking to their ex-spouse and they're already having problems with their children going back and forth and all of that. It's not for that demographic. Who does it suit? And do you have to be speaking to your – I mean, you have to be obviously have some kind of relationship with your
ex-spouse. Well, the trainers will tell you that almost everybody – can go into the system except those that have mental illness or spousal abuse. I think that's how I was trained, at least. And, Michelle, you can weigh in on that. But that, you know, people not talking to each other, you can still bring them into the room and try to get them to reach agreements. It's just if you have people who are crazy, you know, people who are not making decisions based upon reality, or people who are just want to use the system to abuse a spouse, you know, you can't collaborate when it comes to that. But otherwise, you can bring people together, and I don't think it has anything to do with social strata or money either, although I think the system is more expensive up front but cheaper in the long run.
Just to put it a parenthesis around what you just said in relation to Jill's question is, it's not necessarily that they need good communication skills or a good relationship to do collaborative. They just have to be more scared of the system. And if they're scared enough, they'll try and find another way.
Mm-hmm.
And this way could very well be collaborative. Without communication skills, how terrified people are of going through divorce in our system could trump all of that.
Right.
So that's
right,
a reason
yeah.
to go. And one of the things about collaborative, Jill, is that they teach you a little bit about communication skills and listening and bargaining and having conflict. And how to do conflict. I mean, even if a collaboration blows up, in my opinion, you've sent people to divorce at university, to learning school. They've learned a lot about how to disagree. That's worth a lot.
So you're talking about bringing all of these people in to teach and to posture and to do all of these things. Is this really expensive?
Yeah, you know, I think it is up front, to tell you the truth, because you're going to need to hire the financial neutral. You need to hire the person if you've got children's issues. You need to hire your own lawyer and a facilitator. So, yes, it is. But, you know, the studies have shown that even though you meet with all these people and all these expensive people, you might only meet 2, 3, 4, 5 times maybe, as opposed to going to court for 2 or 3 years. In Cook County, some cases, as we know, go 5 years.
Yeah.
Go 5 years. And then there's a ruling that gets, you know, litigated afterwards instead of an agreement reached that people can abide by. So, yes, more money up front, which is unfortunate, but in the long run, again, cheaper.
So
and
Karen,
in so many ways, because still we have the traditional adversarial model has a win-lose paradigm.
Right.
And
right.
a kind of a winner-takes-all thing.
Yeah.
But the thing about family law is you sign up for the adversarial model so you can partake in the win-lose paradigm, and in divorce there is no winning or losing. And even if you think you win, you're never even sure if you won. It's such an obtuse thing, you can't even tell years later who was the winner.
Yeah. Well, Karen, do you have a list of people that are your go-to people on every collaborative case that you do. So you've got a forensic accountant, you've got a psychotherapist, you've got all these people that you use consistently for every case?
I do. I have a group of people who I work with well. You know, and that's kind of a rub, too, because sometimes you say to your client, hey, let's get this neutral, he's really good, and then you try to get the other side to agree, and they're like, well, just because she agrees to it, I'm not going to agree to it. So, you know, there's all of those things that go on, but, you know, the better you are at this kind of stuff, the more you can convince people that what you want is people who are going to work with you, not, advocate. You got to shake every one of that illusion that, advocating on both sides is what you need. You know, and that the working together is the most important thing. But yeah, there are more and more people doing this kind of work, and you know, frankly, I wish there were more.
And but like you have a really good reputation, and it's important to choose a lawyer to do collaborative that's inherently trustable.
That's right.
It's a whole different of adjectives than you might hire to hire a gladiator.
And, you know, and on the other hand, and, you know, one of the things of collaborative, and one of the rules, at least in Illinois, is that if you are in a collaborative divorce as an attorney or a person who's, lending themselves to helping and facilitating, you cannot be part of the divorce. So if I were your collaborative lawyer in that process, I vow and I take the oath that I will not be your lawyer if the case goes to litigation.
You're totally out of the picture, right?
I'm totally out of the picture. So not only am I invested in getting this done, but I have an incentive not to have it break down, and that's a good thing. You know, not that I would do that or care about the money, but there are plenty of lawyers who would.
Right, but people have to understand when they're going into it that although they're entering into this utopian collaborative law process, as you two, you know, seem to think it is, then it could break down, and then they've got to pay a whole new set of attorneys to go into the litigation process, right?
Yeah, it's a problem. And for the high asset cases, if you're an attorney who gets approached, well, would you represent me? Sure. Would you represent me in the collaborative model? Well, you don't want that.
Yeah, of course.
Because you really are going to burn a potential huge fee if you lose them as a client, if the collaborative blows up. And that's true in those big cases. But that doesn't matter. You can't take the 0.1% to measure the effectiveness of this model.
It's
you
gotta
can't.
Come
There's
into
always
vote.
Going to be people who are going to be saying, let's do with what we know. Let's never progress.
Well, I think this is definitely an awareness issue. I mean, if people knew outside of Cook County, in Illinois anyway, or any other state, in the small towns and cities all across America, if they knew about collaborative law, this is certainly a change in divorce culture that I would advocate for, and that I think anybody else who wants to work towards shared parenting and protecting children and putting children first, this would be the way to go.
And don't forget, in medicine, anybody who was talking about alternative ways of healing and diet 10 years ago were called quacks.
Mm-hmm.
And now all of the doctors are doing integrative medicine because they realize that the process of breaking up a family is a holistic process.
You're right.
And you can't serve the children in an adversarial model, for sure, for sure.
We have another call, guys. I'm going to try to grab this again. It's a Skype call, 111 area code. Are you there? Do you have a question? Okay. I'm hanging up on them.
Maybe they could write into the chat room the question.
Right. If you can hear us and you're not hearing me when I'm picking you up, write into the chat room and I'll grab your question from there. Okay. We'll do that.
So what are the things that blow up in the collaborative, Karen? What do you see happens when everybody says, screw you, I'm going to court?
You know, I think there are some people that are angry. You know, many, many divorce litigants are angry, and they almost can't deal with the calmness of everybody because there's techniques that you learn to use that are so foreign to us as attorneys, where you try to calm things down and you never tell people what to do. You try to ask them into making decisions, and I think there are a lot of people who just can't adapt to that. and they think they want something more fiery. And, you know, I mean, how many times as a practicing lawyer, Michelle, do people come to you and say, you know, my buddy got a divorce this way, and my buddy did pull this and did that. I mean, people have expectations, as we keep talking about, that are so foreign to this concept that someone needs to explain to them how it works. But I think there's a distrust that, say, a wife, you know, maybe had been a passive wife, and maybe she didn't know about the finances, and she thinks, well, the husband's just going to finagle his way, and he's going to sweet-talk the financial neutral, and I want a judge. The judge is going to be the one who gets down to it rather than, you know, this individual who's supposed to be neutral. So, you know, I just see a distrust of the system as being the downfall.
And aligning with the military model.
Right.
Of this is a war.
Right.
And we've had that for 40 years. And what do you do when you're in fear? You suit up for battle.
Right.
Which is the worst, the most sabotaging thing you could do to yourself. And yet it's instinctual. The thing... to go into the fear-based system. Fear-based means you get a gladiator, you go fight it out. The collaborative model requires you to come out of the fear and go into problem-solving mode. So in the brain sense, it takes you from the limbic system, the fear-based, into the prefrontal, which is the only way you can solve problems for your family. That's what the collaborative encourages. That's why it's so important in not destroying our families. And, you know, you look at these two-thirds of the children of divorce never want to have kids. 50% don't want to get married. They've watched their parents in the military model, and it's indelibly affected them like nerve gas.
Well,
it
know,
has to change.
Robert Ferrer, Michelle, is in the courtroom. You and I know Robert very
thank
well.
Goodness.
And think so
much
of him.
I thought we were going to have to hang up and not have a Robert Ferrer
and
weigh
not
in.
Have a moment. Well, he's saying this. The problem in family law is that it doesn't take two to tango. A single individual can control the process. That is a big problem inherent with the court system. What if the courtroom is not the first place in the process but the last place?
Well, is that his question?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's more of a statement. You know,
no.
It's like it's one of Robert's statements, but he's right. I mean,
no.
He's absolutely right. The courtroom is the last place that you go to, and he's saying that with this, I think he's agreeing with the collaborative law process.
Oh, sure. Anybody who's ever been hurt by the system is very dedicated to find another way. Either they're so disgusted, they don't even want to hear the word, or they become advocates like you, Jill.
Or they blame their lawyers or the system or the judge, and I see that all the time. And that's what makes practicing law in that realm. It should be very rewarding when you can help people, but the people blame you. You know, they think it's you.
Let's take this question from the 217 area down in our in central Illinois. Can I have your question? Is that you, Robert?
Yeah. We got disconnected prior. You said something about Skype, but it's me. What I was trying to say with that statement, that in Australia, for example, they mandated family centers to deal with issues of divorce. And what happens is that people have been able to go to these family centers throughout the country and through mediation handle their divorce issues. So actually, in Australia, the courtroom is the last place you go. And in fact, what I was going to say about the courtroom being the last place, what if it's through policy that it's mandated that the courtroom is the last place? That is, if it goes to the courtroom, then the judge will be focusing on the fitness of either or both parents. But they can't seem to agree under any circumstances, I would question their fit. Now, the effectiveness of mediation has been confirmed through longitudinal studies. Robert Emery is the big researcher in this area. And what they did as a litmus, that people going through the court, the non-residential parent tends to drop out within 2 to 3 years of court settlement. But in couples going through mediation, both parents remain actively involved throughout the child's life growing up. And they've shown this longitudinally over an 11-year period. So mediation is the only way to go, really. Collaborative law or whatever, ADR, integrated family therapy by Jay LeBeau in Northwestern. So the thing is that we're too focused on going through the courts, and its adversarial system, its approach, is the absolute wrong venue, the wrong thing that that people are forced to face, and it can really destroy any post-divorce cooperative co-parenting, and the children lose out. They just lose out.
Karen, you want
to
comment?
Policy needs to say that the courtroom is the last place.
Robert,
yeah.
Let's like comment on that.
Well, I mean, I don't have much
yeah.
to say. Other, I mean, I agree on all that, but I go back to the idea that maybe we should have some sort of mandatory system at the beginning of this process. Not
that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, because once everyone lodges into their position, you know, and it's adversarial, you can't extricate people from that. They are in the
it's
middle of the war, and they think if
yeah.
they start to try to settle that they're selling out and that they're quitting, whereas, you
we
know,
need
it's
to
not quitting.
The paradigm. Yeah, we
yeah.
need to change the paradigm from the get-go. Everything
thanks,
else
Robert.
Is just a Band-Aid.
Right.
Okay.
Have
bye.
Well, Robert, everything else okay with you other than the system?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you okay?
yeah, Yama, I'm doing well.
All right.
All right, sweetie.
Hey,
if
bye.
The system were different, you'd be doing a lot better.
Robert, I'll call you tomorrow. I forgot to call you back. Sorry.
No problem. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay. He had a great meeting with Andre Katz the other day. Andre is going to be doing some testimony down in Springfield, which is exciting, on the Stephen Watkins Memorial Bill. Of course, both of you know, or Karen, you may not, and you may have heard it while you were down here in Petersburg, but Stephen Watkins was a gentleman that was shot in the back while trying to pick up his daughter for visitation. Do you
oh,
recall
yeah.
that
yeah.
case?
Do you remember that?
So there's a bill in the legislature that's coming up for a vote in the veto session, so that's exciting. That will give that visitation interference bill a little more teeth in Illinois. Very exciting. So
Jill, you and I were talking while we were waiting for Karen about how you thought this might impact the parental alienation and visitation interference issues that you wanted to know from
well, Karen
what
you
thought.
Tell us what you think about that.
Well, no, I mean, tell me exactly what you think what the measures
are. How do you think entering into the collaborative law process will affect parental alienation? Do you think it'll stave it off? Do you think that no matter if an alienator is an alienator is an alienator, if it's a duck, it's a duck, it's a duck. Are you going to be able to change the course of that child's life if that alienator has the inclination to do this brainwashing process to this child? Will that not happen with collaborative law?
Well, I'd like to say that this would be a rosy picture, but you know, I think that what you said is that someone who's going to be, first of all, I think that people who get involved in collaborative law are going to be less likely to alienate. That would be my guess if there was a study done that would show that, because anyone who's willing to come to the table, make agreements, concede things, agree that someone's a good parent, agree that co-parenting is good, work together, is not going to be someone who hates the other side, hates their spouse, and tells their kid, hate him because he's bad. I just don't see that those are the same kinds of people. And I don't see that the system, let's say an alienator goes into that system, I just don't see how the system is going to help them shake that very bad tendency. I just don't see how it would do that.
What you're saying is if there is an alienator in the mix and that personality disorder exists, that 20% of those people who use those alienating tactics are going to be there no matter what. So entering into collaboration, you can do it, and it may or may not work. Probably not. You're going to end up in litigation anyway, I would imagine, because they're hell-bent on getting emotional justice against you at any cost.
They think that parent should not have any visitation or any rights to that kid, and it's only at great reluctance do they ever allow that. Now, could it be that having collaborative people around you and you are saying things like, he's a bad guy, and I told, you know, could it be that there's a shame factor that so many people sitting in a room collaborating could turn to that party and say, you know, do you really think that's the way to encourage a good relationship? And do you think that this is something that's going to help resolve the issues between them and make your child a healthy, happy child? Will that change someone to not be an alienator, maybe there's a percentage that would see the light there, Jill, but I think for the most part they're going to do what they're going to do.
And the other side of the coin, Karen, is that a moderate alienator can get amped up participating in the system to an extreme alienator because
right.
the anger gets amped up and the fear of losing access, primary control of a child. So
I think you're
the
right,
opposite is true. I mean, if you can get anybody to the mediation table or the collaborative table, even if you think they're a complete jerk and you can do it, even if they think they're going to manipulate you, it may be worth a try.
You could lead them down a different path for sure.
Yeah, or as Jill and I say, it could take them into the orange zone instead of the full-blown red.
Right.
Right. Right.
How often, Karen, do you think you do, I mean, how often do you do this? How many collaborative law cases do you have right now?
I have one right now. I've had about four. They are not common. And I
no.
can tell you, you know, some people will, you know, even with mediation, people will call me to be their lawyer and then we'll get a mediator, you know, because they can't really talk to me about a divorce and then have them be my mediator, because what husband or wife would want me to be in the middle when I've already talked to somebody? So it's a hard thing to market in a way. How do you market yourself as a collaborative lawyer when people don't understand what it is and people want to know what their rights are to begin with? It's you know.
Needless to say, it's so big in California. I was the keynote speaker for the Collaborative Bar in California, right? And so many of the big-time warriors in the court system had said enough and had given up and said, I'm never going to try another case. And some of the finest lawyers have moved to the collaborative lawyer. But, you know, that's California. And when I gave the keynote, there was hundreds of people there. I got a standing ovation. I'll talk about collaborative law somewhere else, and they'll be lucky if they look up. California. But
well,
then again,
and
California, no fault, California, joint parenting.
Well, and it's progressive. I mean, progressive to a point there, but I think it goes back to the awareness thing. And the more we talk about collaborative law, the more people who have the qualities that are needed to make it successful will enter into that arena. But I still think you have those people who are part of this system that want that justice, and they're going to go in and get into the whirlwind of adversarial divorce and be stuck there for years and years and years.
Well,
and
you know what? In Chicago, I think we're so far away from that, unfortunately, unless there's a huge, epiphany here, because not only are they not interested in collaborative law, but most litigants want to hire the lawyer who's the fiery, stoke the fire kind of lawyer. I mean, I always have this theory that, you know, how dogs and their owners look alike and act alike. I think that lawyers and their clients are alike. And you have an angry, bitter client, you're going to get an angry, bitter lawyer. And so to kind of perpetuate that whole dynamic. And so, I mean, I still see people hiring people who you know are litigious and awful and nasty just for that reason.
There's no financial incentive for a lawyer to resolve something quickly. There is no financial incentive. It feeds everybody else and pays, you know, secretaries' salaries. Their overhead is taken care of. So there is no financial incentive. They want to take it all the way. And so collaborative law, although I think, I mean, you could have 400 collaborative law cases and probably make the same amount of money.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I think good lawyers, and we get such a bad rap, but I mean, so there for every one lawyer who stokes the fire and thinks they can make a ton of money on a case, there's probably 50 lawyers who would cut their bill and try to get things done because that's the right thing to do.
Well,
you know, go ahead.
Karen, why don't you give us your information, your contact information?
Before she does it, I just want to say whether you're talking collaborative, mediation, or traditional adversarial model with a gladiator for a lawyer, Karen Conte knows how to do it all. And she's one of the finest we have coming out of Cook County. And I just needed to tell you that.
Well, thank you so much. You got to wear both hats, right?
What's your contact information?
You can go to adamskiandconte.com, A-D-A-M-S-K-I, and Conte, my name, C-O-N-T-I. That's Karen Conte. And you can get all my contact information from there. And I'll tell you my phone number, which is 312 312- 312-7800, which is 312-FEAR-800.
Perfect. Oh, great. Well,
we know what hat that is.
Way too fast. Way too fast. So we have to have you back. In fact, we've offered Karen a show on syndicatednews.net and right now. Thank you, Karen, for coming.
You're welcome. I'm sorry for being late. I'll have to punish the judge next time. Okay.
Tune in. 2 weeks from tonight, we have David Goldman on our show talking about the Brazilian abduction of his child. And so that'll be an exciting show. And 2 weeks after that, we have Bill Hudson, Kate Hudson's dad. So everybody tune in. We love having you. Thanks for listening.
Thank you so much, Karen.
All right. Have a nice night.
Talk to you soon. Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, everybody. Thanks for joining us.